The next case is 97-1284, Cleveland Bar Association versus Leslie Knowlton. Ms. McLaughlin? I'm sorry, Mr. Snyder, first. Does the amount of money make it malpractice or discipline? Is that how we determine it? Or?
Not only the amount of money, but the duration and the number of times that he failed to perform each check that came in over the period of time.
Yeah, I guess your point would be that he, by loaning money to the trust, he was active in the trust. I mean, it wasn't like as if he'd forgotten about the trust and just forgot to put the checks, deposit the checks, but he... So do we know from the record, well, I guess we don't know from the record, why he didn't deposit those checks?
The response that was given during the testimony, Your Honor, was that it was all these times were difficult.
It was emotional. That was the only, wasn't any other reason.
Yeah. I'd like, however, to call the attention during the pendency of the Dura estate, which was an estate for one of the partners of his law firm. During the years 1975 to 1980, he failed to deposit a total of $12,455.82. And most importantly, too, he failed to properly account for that at the probate court of Cobb County when he filed the probate proceedings there. He failed to include that. and he further failed to deliver a $24,000, almost $25,000 check to the beneficiary, and continued this deception of misrepresentation when he converted the balance of the money to his own personal use. And he used that money, as he said, and he admitted, to pay his personal taxes. The settlement in that matter came to $129,500, and then it was $5,000 in attorney fees. At this point, I'd like to reserve time for my associate counsel for approximately 6 minutes, 7 minutes to respond to. I just want to add in conclusion, Your Honors, Justices of the Court, that the conversions that took place were not by a practitioner who didn't have available to him and the expertise of his fellow practitioners. He was in a large firm. He was in a managing partner at one time on the managing committee. He was a person who was uniquely qualified to know estate and trust. That was his field. In mitigation, he said, learning the new tax code was very difficult. Well, I concede it is difficult, but every lawyer has to learn new codes, new rules, new procedures that is handed down in every area of the law. We are entrusted with that responsibility. We feel and object to the finding of the one-year suspension. We feel that his conversion of funds and that the decisions of this court has provided us with a direction that the disbarment is the only reaction that should be in this case. I'd like to reserve the time for Ms. McLaughlin to respond as you like.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Mr. Doyle.
Here's the panel's report. Seldom we have such a variation here. You have a panel saying 2 years, the board 1 year, relator disbar. I suspect you'd like it dismissed.
Well, you know, I'm a man of reality. I can't say that to you. But from the standpoint of the position taken by the other side, I think I would have to suggest that it's incredibly extreme based on the cases that I've looked at. I would not suggest to this court that there should be probation. I think, as Mr. Knowlton acknowledged and still acknowledges, his wrongfulness here. But we believe that, based at this point on a number of factors that I'll get into in mitigation, that the appropriate sanction is what the board actually reviews in this case and what they recommend. I think, Justice Moore, you mentioned a question about the checks not being deposited and that sort of thing. In the testimony at the hearing, Dr. Moore has testified to what occurred here. And it was a confluence of events, what we now know as sleep apnea, coupled with the fact that this man was going through serious emotional problems involving his family, and his professional career. You heard the evidence or probably read the testimony concerning what was going on in the large brothers investment and what was happening to the estate tax planners.
But that's not a, frankly, that's not a very persuasive argument, that the law was changing and that the lawyer had to learn new law. And I'll let you make the argument, but it's you need to really be very persuasive on that argument, because well, that's the challenge, everybody. When that's a changing field and lawyers move from firm to firm and the law changes and there are pressures and, if we're gonna have our code of professional responsibility based upon those factors, then we need to change the code, it seems to me, and lower the expectations of people for lawyers, because that many, many lawyers have pressures, extreme pressures, and they don't violate the code of conduct.
I understand that, Chair. What I'm saying to you is this, that coupled with these other factors, it's not just that alone. I'm only giving you that as part of the picture, I believe, that demonstrates the difficulties that this man is going through.
Mr. Snyder mentioned the fact that Mr. Knowlton, of course, is in a large, distinguished law firm in Cleveland, and he could have gotten help. Is there anything in the record about that? Why he didn't, or rather he did seek help from either associates or partners?
Your Honor, the testimony came out from various individuals who saw him, I guess, falling asleep at the switch. And he did not, meaning Mr. Knowlton, did not come forward. And his partners, for one reason or another, there was no interaction on that issue. However, there was a discussion that he had, I think it was early in the 1990s, with one of the managing partners about how he was doing. He wasn't crazy enough to work with himself at that time. There's no question about that. And as Mr. Snyder says, this is a large firm. But large firms doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the help if you don't seek it out. And he didn't. I don't think we can walk away from that issue. But the problem as he faced at that time was he was facing the sleep apnea, which I'm going to basically chronic fatigue is what Dr. Morgan said. They described it as sort of a constant jet lag. The man was walking into the office, he was sleeping in meetings. The doctor felt that this would have impacted his ability to make decisions. What we're saying to you is that coupled with the other issues that were going on in his life, all affected his ability to make the proper decision. We're not telling you at all to excuse it. We're trying to explain it.
Well, that's an argument in favor of against disbarment, that often, too often, we see lawyers who intentionally do things that they're quite mischievous in what they do. Here, I think what you're saying is that his conduct was a result of neglect, both of his clients and of himself. Really, he didn't acknowledge to himself and others that he had a problem that was affecting his work. Is that your argument? I mean, it seems like that's...
That is what brought him to the area that brought us here. The trail began in the 1970s. The evidence showed that he was consulting in the mid-70s with a doctor from the Cleveland Clinic concerning his depression, his fatigue. It went up into the 80s. There was a sleep test given to him in 1989. He was told to get into the therapy. He didn't. He had another consultation in 1992. The record clearly shows that this was an ongoing medical problem.
So, with proper medical treatment, this sleep disorder is regulated and it's brought under control. And there's once that's done, you get back to his fairly normal life.
Correct.
Yeah. Are you telling us that he was informed of this malady, but that he didn't take the advice of his medical experts?
No, at that time, in 1989, you'll see in the records, there's a letter from Dr. Dudley Dinner, who we met with, and the the records reflect that he was having a problem sleeping, and that sort of thing. And at that time, the discussion between Mr. Norton and between the doctor, I don't know that I can come up in the record, but it clearly shows that he did not follow up after that. No question about that. When he did follow up, and he did this in 95, we have Dr. Brooks clearly has indicated that there has been a continued turnaround in terms of his recovery, that this has certainly affected, given him, affected his lease on life as it relates to his ongoing health, depression.
I don't notice any alcohol or drug problem in his life. Is that correct?
No, there's none of that.
So the main reason that he failed in his attorney capacity was the sleep disorder and his not taking proper care of that disorder because of why? Why didn't he do that?
Judge, I think it's that disorder, but there's a confluence of that along with there were serious family problems.
Because I know several attorneys who have that problem. You go to work every day and they do their job properly and they take care of themselves. I'm missing the point of why he didn't, like all other people, take care of himself.
Okay. He didn't take care of himself. That's kind of the record. No question on that. The question that occurs here is that as he tried to take care of whatever he was doing, I think the fatigue issue, as you read in Dr. Morgan's testimony, it affected his decision-making ability. And then when you couple that with his professional and personal depression going on, all of these things merge, and he was not making the right decision. We're not denying any of that. He should have gotten up, and he should have gotten help. He didn't do that. And that's why we're here today. But he has gotten help now, and I think that the record will clearly show that he has improved and he's back on track.
You said you wanted to get to the mitigation.
Yes, I do.
I think we...
If I may, I think on the other side of the coin, I would like to at least demonstrate to you the issues that I think we brought out in our brief, which is one, that you are aware of the full restitution. As he indicated, he has paid over $300,000 out of his retirement funds from Arrowhead. That's money that he paid. It came out directly. They negotiated the settlements, but he paid. As far as the cooperation, he cooperated totally in with this entire investigation. He admitted his wrongdoings right from the beginning. You'll note that in the record, Mr. Cornett, who was the investigating attorney from Arrowhead, he investigated other facts here. He found that they reviewed other files that Mr. Nolan had reviewed and worked on. This is the only instance of practice that stemmed from 1968 or 65 of any instance of any wrongdoing. That they found. They did their own investigation. He's cooperated. As far as this incident, I talked about the Dura issue, what he did at that time was wrong, and was based on what we believe was a medical malady. He made wrong decisions. The man who was doing those things at the same time, just a distinguished member of the bar in the state, the record, as you will look through his resume, is filled with the things that he has done on behalf of the Bar Association. He has lectured local state, Clinton Bar, National Bars, his own state planners associations. He has been an officer, he has been a trustee. He has done many, many things to affect and bring forth the name of the Bar Association. And I guess what I'm asking at this time is his demonstration of what he has been throughout his career, and this career has stemmed almost 30-some years. And here he stands today, facing what has already occurred, which is humiliation. He's been kicked out of his law firm. Now he stands before you, waiting for you to determine what's going to happen. I know know that the cases that you have reviewed, whether misappropriations, our association wants you to spark. We would ask you to look to the case of warrants, state warrants, to the Cleveland local lawyer. I think there are striking similarities between that case and what has happened.
Counsel, you're claiming what sounds to me mostly as a medical excuse for his conduct, the apnea, depression, etc. But I find it curious, and I'd like to hear your explanation of why that was a selected medical problem. These two files are the only files he had this problem on for the numerous years. How come that didn't affect the rest of this file, the rest of his facts that truly was causing him to perform for us? I don't understand the selective nature of this medical problem, and why we focused on only two files to misappropriate funds.
As you're already aware, Your Honor, the real estate spanned a great deal of time. And what he was supposed to do was put money into a checking account. A simple thing of a check coming in, put it into the account. And he didn't do it. As Mr. Knowles testified at the hearing, he said, I froze that file. He didn't address it. He didn't address it for whatever reason. You have a man on one side who is lecturing to hundreds of lawyers about state planning and doing things and being a magnificent attorney. And on the other hand, he couldn't do the mundane things such as this, put the money in the check.
That sounds more like deliberate choice than it does the medical condition of giving back.
Well, I don't know that I would call it choice. I would call it basically freezing on the file. I mean, I think there are people...
That's a new and novel term to me. Wouldn't a more logical explanation be, or couldn't a logical explanation be, that for whatever reason, he forgot to deposit a check. Then some time passes, and he discovers that, and now he's saying, geez, you know, my client's going to be mad, or is this now proud? And so then he just compounds it because he can't figure out how to straighten out the first one. It seems to me that's logically what happened here. It doesn't seem to me there'd be any other explanation that he goofed sometime at the front end of this, discovers it somewhat later, and then yikes, you know, I'm in big trouble here. Instead of confronting that trouble, then just compounds that over time. That would seem to me that one wouldn't be related to sleep disorder. That would be related to a conscious effort to cover up what was probably malpractice at the front end. But it gets deeper and gets into the, it would seem, into the disciplinary rules as it goes on.
That would also suggest that that was a case of inevitability. Square was going to die, and all these issues were going to come forward. It was all going to come out. It's not that you could cover it up. So it's not like...
Well, but he lived a long time on covering it up.
And that's what happened. Yeah. And that's what I use the term freeze, because I think that's what he did. He didn't do anything. And that's how he addressed that problem. He just didn't want to think about it. He didn't do anything. So, I mean, that's...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, that's
right. She may have.
I accept whatever help I can get from the court. At this point, I see a red light is on. If there's any questions or any answers.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Ms. McLaughlin, you have 8 minutes that Mr. Snyder saved for you.
Representing the mayor of the Bar Association. I would like to point out a few things to the court. Although we acknowledge that the mayor may have developed a natural recognition of the area of estates and trusts, his primary responsibility was to his client, his attorney. And whether or not the failure to deposit in the year trust started out as a neglect and then advanced into something else, the Dora estate, something completely different. Here's the case where one part of the check was sent to the trust that was set up for the daughter who was still subject to a trust, and the other half of the trust money, the almost $25,000, was not sent to Jeff Dura. He was now an adult, not subject to a trust. And Mr. Nolson rationalized it by saying, oh, well, I thought there was a contingency fee that I collected because I got some more benefits that weren't expected, and I thought I would just pay back later on. Well, Your Honor, my background is as a prosecutor, and the only thing that I see in there is stealing. And I think that that's what this comes down to. This court has been very clear.
Can you explain why the Chatham County prosecutor didn't see it that way?
Your Honor, no, I can't. I know that a lot of money was paid to a lot of people to settle this case out. I don't think that should ever be dispositive of what I think is a criminal violation. And I think that because the Duras were, Mr. Dura resides in California, and nobody else seems to be really jumping up and down about it, that the county prosecutor simply looked at it, why the decision was made, and decided not to prosecute. That's obviously their decision. As a current prosecutor, I think that that was probably incorrect.
Let me ask you, Mr. McLaughlin, the cases that you've cited for disbarment seem to be distinguishable on their facts. The conduct in Batt, for example, and Sterner was more egregious. In one case, that there was no accounting for the funds, and there was the theft in office and prosecution convictions. Disbarment is obviously a very extreme sanction. We don't disbar many lawyers in Ohio, as you know. It's reserved for those most egregious acts of conduct. I guess I'm wondering. I'm not quite sure why the Cleveland Bar is asking for disbarment here. It does seem to me that one of the elements we usually, at least I look at, is to determine whether the respondent is contrite, whether he or she recognizes that they've made a mistake, whether there seems to be conduct that for which the person can be rehabilitated, if that's the right term. Certainly a sanction for the lawyer to sit out some time, no question about that in my mind, but this doesn't seem to me like a disbarment case, frankly. This conduct is certainly highly inappropriate, but it's not the kind of egregious conduct that for which we reserve disbarment, it seems. What's your argument?
The later book primarily at the case law, Mr. Doyle cited to the Lawrence case, which is a 1995 case, and the trends from then, he said in the rest of 95, so far back to 96 and 97, this court again has said that the proper sanction or appropriate sanction for misappropriation of client funds is disbarment. Whether or not this court decides on a disbarment or something less like an indefinite suspension, Relator certainly believes that the 1 year that the Board of Grievances recommended was simply completely out of step with the case law since the Lawrence decision. They relied very heavily on the Lawrence decision in their facts. The talking about the violations was a paragraph, and the mitigation was like 2.5 pages. And the Relator simply believes that the case law that this court has evolved over the last 2.5 years, plus the fact that unfortunately we see a lot of these cases. Now, unfortunately, every time I pick up Obar every week, I see again and again and again, attorneys stealing funds from their clients, and especially when it comes, quite frankly, to dead people, especially estates and trust attorneys, and when it comes to people that may not be in a position to ever find out about it. Mr. Doyle said that, well, the relator froze on the account and was unable to handle these two accounts. Relator might have said that there maybe was a more sinister aspect with it. He thought that because Mrs. Weir no longer was looking for distribution checks, that he could simply ignore the file, and once he did the first check, which is easier to never acknowledge it. And second of all, the firm is the one who discovered the violations, and they confronted him with it. And even at that time, he didn't bring up the Dura matter. He went and said, yes, I did the same with the Weir matter, wrote a big long letter that's in the record. And then they went to his office, Mr. Cornett did, and found this reference to the Dura. So simply went, well, this is a little thing. You've got one thing at the weird state, you've got a whole other thing stealing that's almost $25,000. And this is not a man who was working for a law firm not making a lot of money. This man had resources. He was in a prestigious law firm, obviously, I presume with a commensurate salary for his position. And later might submit that, as he would submit that, that maybe he just thought that, well, he could get away with it, that he needed the money at the time. And that that's something a little more sinister than just a neglect argument. And that a depression or sleep apnea simply cannot balance out what he did. And that whether or not this court decides on a disbarment, certainly what the Board of Commissioners recommended is not sufficient to ensure that the board has a trust in the integrity of the disciplinary system. And later, that's the primary job here, is we have a job to protect the public. The public doesn't have the ability to look at lawyers, you know, when they look somebody up and say, this is the word, this is the bad word. They rely on the disciplinary process, they rely on word of mouth, and that the disciplinary process is here for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.